Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life. The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Moed Tov, how are you doing?
Moedim Lesimcha, we're definitely not going to say Shavua Tov today.
I know, it gets too confusing, the whole thing.
I hope that everybody's enjoying a good Sukkot, and of course, in Sukkot, we have to focus on the weather, right? That's the main thing about Sukkot. I hope that your Sukkot has been dry. In Israel, it certainly has been dry, a little cooler, which is really pleasing. And of course, the regular round of Sukkot stories. The main story that I've seen, which attracted my attention, is one about a sukkah that was built in Jerusalem on a platform which rested on a scaffolding construction. I think it was 12 meters up. I'm guessing that it was kind of in line with somebody's balcony, which was right up there on the first floor or something like that. This mishmash of scaffolding on the pavement outside with a platform on top and then the sukkah resting on that, obviously without proper approval from the local authorities, considered to be a danger to life and limb, not only for those in the sukkah, but indeed for those nearby, underneath, downstairs. And so the municipality had to come in and physically dismantle, destroy the sukkah, with lots and lots of protests and opposition from the local ultra-Orthodox community living in the area. There were riots, clashes with police. There were
people are on edge,
rubbish bins that were set up and that were set on fire in order to try to prevent the authorities from dismantling the sukkah. We definitely don't need another disaster involved with people taking unnecessary risks. And so obviously I would very much support the authorities in their quest to keep things safe and to dismantle a sukkah like that, even though we all want to have a sukkah handy to our home, even if we live on the first floor. The truth of the matter is that many people do have a balcony. People who live in apartment buildings, they have a balcony and they find a way somehow to build a sukkah on the balcony. Or indeed, a lot of people build the sukkahs in the parking lot of their apartment buildings, and you see this long electric cable being led from their own personal apartment to the sukkah to light it up, and of course on their own personal electricity account rather than taking electricity from the communal areas or from somebody else. So this is also a very common thing that we see here during Sukkot. Welcome to Sukkot in Israel. It always has a little bit of a spice and a story attached
to it. Absolutely incredible. Wow, and quite scary as well. It's just a wonder that somebody would be happy to balance on that platform. Wow, makes me nauseous just thinking about it.
I mean, I have seen some. I must be honest and say that quite near to where I live locally, there's one sukkah that gets built on this platform every single year. I assume that they've received authority to build that, and from the local municipality, and it seems relatively sturdy, and it's been up there every year for the last 10 years at least that I can recall, every year the same setup, but it kind of does look a little weird, I have to tell you.
Crazy. There's a great deal of controversy brewing as the U.S. Democrats have had an internal disagreement of whether the U.S. should be helping fund the Israeli Iron Dome system or not. Give us some context here, please.
So this is a budget bill that is being put together by the U.S. Democrats, Joe Biden's Democratic Party in the U.S., to fund $1 billion for the replenishment of Israel's Iron Dome rockets. This was something that Joe Biden had mentioned after the recent conflict, the recent Gaza conflict in May. He apparently reached out to then Prime Minister Netanyahu, assuring him that the U.S. would assist Israel in providing the $1 billion required to replenish the supplies of these rockets. Let's just bear in mind that the rockets are actually produced in the U.S. by a U.S. company. And so this money that's being earmarked to help Israel, and of course really does help Israel, because the results of the product that's being produced comes to Israel and allows Israel to defend itself against attacks that we've seen from Gaza on an ongoing basis. But the money is actually being spent in the US. That's quite a common requirement that's laid down when money is lent from one country to another, that the money is actually spent with people who reside in the country which is providing the money. So in a way, it becomes some sort of a way of boosting the economy of their own country. The controversy around this is that there is a group within the Democratic Party who feels that it's inappropriate for the U.S. to be funding these rockets that are being produced for the Iron Dome system, because of the fact that so many Palestinians, it claims, have been casualties as Israel has struck back against rocket fire from Gaza. Now, one of the things that we can be relatively sure of is that the Iron Dome system doesn't actually produce casualties. It's not an offensive system. It's rather a defensive system, which on the contrary actually prevents casualties rather than producing casualties. So this whole argument, in my estimation, seems to be a little bit of a storm in a teacup and an attempt to just try to introduce some political aspect to the Israeli-Palestinian, the Israeli-Gaza conflict within the U.S. by coming up and saying that by producing these rockets and by allowing the U.S. to fund, provide budget money for the replenishment of these rockets, that this is a cause of Palestinian casualties, I think is a little bit of a stretch in terms of the reality of the situation. But that is really what it's about. The bill was within the budget, then it was removed from the budget. Now my understanding is that it's back in the budget again. There are some very, very strong proponents, even within the U.S. Democratic Party, trying to support the idea of having this budget within allocated by the U.S. to allow the rockets to be replenished. It's clear that from an Israeli defensive perspective, these rockets are critical. There's no doubt that we need them, that every time rockets are fired from Gaza, Israel needs to somehow be able to defend the general public, which it has done so successfully with the Iron Dome system, even though the Iron Dome itself is not 100% foolproof, that there are times when it slips up and that there are casualties on the Israeli side of the fence rather than on the Palestinian side of the fence. But of course, you know, those who wish to know it, and those who wish to ignore it will ignore it. And that's, of course, what we're seeing in this battle that's going on within the Democratic Party for the budget at the moment.
Yeah, I would suggest it's probably more about them than it is. It's more about what's going on internally within the Democratic Party than it is anything else. Because it will get passed irrespective. Because the Republicans want it, most of the Democrats probably will want this to go ahead. So therefore, to me, what it signals is just the divide within the Democratic Party.
I think it does signal something of a divide within the Democratic Party. And of course, there are factions within the Democratic Party. They've got their own political agendas that they're trying to follow. And some of them are looking for every possible way to oppose things that Joe Biden and his supporters are proposing. And of course, this just presents another opportunity for them. I'd like to think that the budget will be approved by hook or by crook in one way or another. If it's not done through this bill, then it's done somehow through another bill. The administration certainly has the flexibility to somehow introduce budgetary options in a way that may not necessarily be governed by the House of Representatives, which is what this is being caught up in at the moment. But I agree with you that I think the majority of people understand the requirement, understand the need, the importance, and that the budget will somehow be passed in one way or another.
The annual United Nations General Assembly meeting and speeches have begun. The commemoration of the Durban conference turned into something of a non-event. Tell us about this. We've, of course, been following the build-up to this as one country after another pulled out of the so-called Durban conference. What happened now?
Yeah, so they had the event which was held at the United Nations. This was an event that was designed to commemorate 20 years since the 2001 original Durban conference, actually, which was held, surprisingly enough, in Durban, and turned out to be a real hotbed for anti-Semitism. It was originally designed to be an anti-racism conference meeting. It was billed as such. People came along. Many countries were very eager to get involved because the headline was something that appealed to them, that they wanted to be involved in. And then it became hijacked somehow by anti-Israel and anti-Semitic supporters. And that's really the way that Durban has been since 2001. There have been a number of conferences. I believe that this one, the 20th anniversary version, is the fourth conference, that's a meeting that's been held under the Durban banner. And fortunately, it turned into something, a non-event. I think there were 34 countries that were ultimately convinced to boycott their attendance at this particular commemoration, and that there were, in fact, counter conferences, in particular one that was held, a virtual conference that was sponsored within New York City as well, to try to oppose the whole anti-Semitic sentiment, which has been so virulent within this whole Durban group environment. Call it what you wish, it's become something of a a thing with so many people supporting it and so many people coming out against it. But ultimately, fortunately, it was kind of very much a non-event. And, you know, I was really pleased to see the list of countries who decided to boycott them. They were proud. They published their names. They were willing to come out publicly and say that this is not what we are about. So that was really very, very pleasing to see. And so it kind of became almost a nothing event in the end, which is really where it belongs. But of course, the main event of the United Nations, which is the addresses by various country leaders, some of whom are addressing the General Assembly in person and some of whom are addressing the General Assembly virtually, has begun. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is due to travel personally to New York on Saturday evening. His address to the General Assembly will take place on Monday. I'm not quite sure exactly what time that is due to take place. He will, of course, present his speech in person rather than virtually. And let's hope that it will be before Monday evening sets in and before Simchat Torah in Israel at least actually begins, because obviously people will want to watch it. So I'm hoping that they would schedule it for relatively early in the day on Monday, New York time, which allows people in Israel still to watch it before we begin the Hakafot in the evening on Monday evening. But in the meantime, we've already seen Boris Johnson and Prime Minister, the Iranian President Raisi, and of course we've also seen King Abdullah of Jordan make their presentations to the United Nations. King Abdullah did his in a virtual manner, so he wasn't personally present. He used the opportunity to call again for the two-state solution. That's what he thinks, and that's what his speech really was surrounded, you know, was concentrated on. The one thing that really surprised me out of everything that's going on in the United States surrounding the United Nations parley is the fact that Boris Johnson was invited to the White House, which apparently he spent an hour and a half meeting with Joe Biden. I hope he stayed awake this time. But it surprised me that this was the first time that a British Prime Minister has been invited to the White House to meet the U.S. President in 4 years. I don't know if that caught your attention and if that sounds surprising to you.
Yeah, it does.
But that was really something that was very surprising to me when you consider that during the same period of time, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu probably went to the White House 3 or 4 times during those 4 years. I'm guessing it was something like that. So very surprising.
Incredible.
And of course, there was a plan to somehow get the countries involved in the Iranian nuclear agreement to meet together around the edges of the United Nations conference. Excuse me, that seems not to be happening now. So, at least for now, the whole Iranian nuclear deal seems to be on hold.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Before I let you go, can you just give us an update as to what's going on in terms of COVID in Israel?
Yeah, so the headline today on the COVID issue, of course, we continue to battle COVID. The third vaccination program continues to roll out. Thousands of Israelis presenting themselves to be tested for fear of having been exposed to someone with COVID. Lots and lots of discussions about what's the right approach and what's the wrong approach, and a lot of controversial debate around whether the vaccines are really working or not, particularly given that the number of seriously ill people in Israel is on the increase, number of people in hospitals on the increase, and perhaps most controversially, the age of the people who are seriously ill dropping quite dramatically. When we look and see who are the people who are in hospital, who are suffering, people who are dying, then the average age seems to be dropping quite dramatically. There is no doubt that the vast majority of people who are in hospital, who are sick, who are requiring ventilation, and indeed those who are dying, are people who have not been vaccinated. That continues to be the case. And the theory that's being attributed to why the age is dropping in terms of the number of people who are seriously ill is because the younger people are less likely to be vaccinated than older people. And that is the reason that's being given for why the average age is dropping. Also on the COVID front, two more little pieces of information. First of all, the annual Birkat HaKohanim, the blessing of the priests at the Kotel during the festival of Sukkot, has this year been divided into 2 days rather than the usual one day, when it can see up to 100,000 people turn up at the Kotel at the Western Wall.
I was wondering why I saw it was blessing. There was some that it took place yesterday as well. It doesn't normally happen so early
right.
on.
Mm. Exactly. So not usually yesterday, because of course yesterday was still a Chag holiday for those who observe according to the customs of the diaspora. And usually it is held today, which allows all of those people, including those who are keeping 2 days of Sukkot, to attend. So yesterday some people attended and today it will happen again under so-called COVID restrictions only in inverted commas. 8,000 people allowed to attend at the Kotel, being divided up into capsules of 15 people, all divided up at the Kotel in an attempt to try somehow to keep things rolling, but also to keep it safe. And lots of discussion about how to get the kids back to school after Sukkot in a way that will not require so many people to go into quarantine as a result of having been exposed to someone with the virus.